On Memorial Day weekend in May 1990, Paige Rinkowski's car was found idling on the shoulder of a busy Michigan highway. Her purse, shoes, and keys were inside, but Paige was gone. What happened in those hours between her last conversation on the roadside and the moment her car was discovered remains one of Michigan's most haunting mysteries. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane. At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Belle Adams.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, I just told you that we are going to be covering a case today from the 90s, and then you flirted out that you're uncomfortable talking about the 90s.
I'm not uncomfortable talking about the 90s, exactly, because I mean, I look back at those years with like fondness. I was a teenager in the 90s, and I guess you're only 3 years younger than me, so you must have been a teenager through the 90s, too.
Yes. And I mean, so, I don't look at the 90s with fondness.
Oh, you don't. I mean, I think we had very different
Teenage experiences.
And for the most part, mine was much more probably like sheltered or cushy.
Right.
Than yours.
Mine was not.
Yours was not. You had a more 90s harshness. I was like, oh, the 90s are cool.
Yeah.
But anyway, and most of the time when we've been talking about these cases, it's been teenagers disappearing in the 90s. And then I'm sitting here half the time while you're talking to me doing math and being like, okay, they would be approximately our ages, like, or maybe just a tiny bit older. And then I start thinking about all the life they missed out on, like schooling and marriages and babies and all those other nice things we had. And then I just start feeling terrible that there's somebody out there that all of these things that happen to all of these women are completely mindless, a complete waste, awful things. And because of that awful moment, they didn't get to do all those many years of things that we get to do.
Right.
So it's hard.
Yeah. I mean, so today we're going to talk about someone who was a little bit older during the 90s. So an adult person.
An adult person. Right. Okay.
But also, yeah, that same thing. I was thinking about that a lot, about how much life she missed, how much she had planned for, as I was working on today's episode. So I think it hits maybe a little bit differently, but it's that same concept of like really exploring and thinking about who she was and what she wanted to do with her life. And then knowing that she didn't get to do those things is really hard for every episode, I think. But I think that's also how we do need to know about who she is as a person, right? To really understand what happened to her and like why telling these stories matters.
Right.
Which is like, you know, one thing I like about doing our podcast is that we're able to provide a lot of information about who they were.
Right. Right. And sometimes when they are a little bit older, we have a lot more information than if they go missing as a teenager.
Right.
There's often not much information about kids.
Yeah. Because just they haven't had the ability to experience a lot of different things.
Right.
But are you ready to get started?
Sure.
Okay. I've been doing this a lot to you lately, so I'm just warning you, we're diving straight in.
Okay.
And sometimes you just are like, what are we doing?
So, oh my God. Oh, we're starting on the day?
The day. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You have been doing that a lot.
Yeah. Like,
where's the story first, Amy?
Oh,
are we going to go back?
We're going to go back, but like every time I do it, you're shocked. So
I know. I don't know why. Look, I need to learn at some point.
Right. Okay.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. At 7:58 p.m. on May 24th, 1990, a call comes in to 911. On the other end is a man who had been driving along Interstate 96 in Michigan and had spotted a car on the shoulder near the Fowlerville exit earlier that day. When he passed by again, he saw it still there with its headlights on, and he became concerned. The Livingston County Sheriff's Office found the 1986 silver two-door Oldsmobile Cutlass Clay on the westbound side of the highway about a quarter mile from the exit. It was pulled over on the shoulder, and just as the caller had stated, its headlights were on. Strangely, even though no one was around, the engine was still running. Opening the unlocked driver's side door, they shut the car off. Inside on the seat was a purse that belonged to a 30-year-old woman named Paige Rinkowski.
It's so strange. It's kind of like Brianna Maitland, where, like, the lights were still on there, too. Just somebody just completely...
Yeah. So the car's there, car's on.
Yeah. And they just completely disappear from their existence with the car still going.
Yeah. Now, they flag the car as abandoned, and they call for a tow truck, and the car was removed from the highway. They did run the plates, and they found the Cutlass was registered to Trilon Corp and used by a woman named Artis Waite Ronkowski. Paige was her daughter. The sheriff's office called Artis's home phone and left a message on her answering machine to let her know that her car was found on the side of the highway. Within a few hours, though, it will become clear that something deeply troubling has happened to Paige. Now, this story begins with a car on the side of the interstate, but it will turn into a 35-year hunt for information in the disappearance of Paige Ronkowski. Now, Paige's story, I think, represents one of the types of disappearances we're most afraid of, that kind that feels like it comes like a lightning bolt out of the blue. One day she's going about her everyday life, the next she's gone.
And we were just talking about this, too, and It's not that typical, right?
Right. No, hers is one of the rarest categories. It's the suspected stranger abduction of an adult woman. Exact numbers are really hard to pin down because missing persons and abduction cases are classified in many different types of ways. But what we do know is the vast majority of abductions are carried out by family members or acquaintances. Only a very small fraction fit into like the classic stranger stereotype where someone is taken suddenly by a person they don't know at all. And that's part of what makes Paige's case so unsettling. Like, it embodies the kind of disappearances we're warned about from childhood, the ones that we imagine when we think of danger, even though statistically speaking, it's rare.
Right. I mean, the vast majority of the time it's a family member, husband, boyfriend, somebody like that.
I mean, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're taught to fear it's the stranger danger situation.
Right. Right. I remember that as a kid, too. Yeah. The whole stranger danger thing.
Yeah.
And it's not that true.
No. So, like, most abductions don't happen in this way. But it's the one that we, like, fear.
But even any kind of abuse, it's never, like, the stranger. It's always the trusted adult.
Yeah, statistically speaking.
I mean, this is an adult that disappeared. But, like, when we're talking to kids, you know, we're always like, oh, you know, you need to be afraid of these strangers. When really it's like, maybe we should be worrying about being alone with that uncle or that teacher or, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Something more typical. So
Paige herself, though. Paige is really one of the last people that you'd ever expect to go missing.
Is there a reason for that?
This is where I want to tell you about Paige.
Okay.
I fall kind of in love with every single person that we talk about. And just like Paige is just, I don't know. I got this like sense as I was working on her story that she's got this like glow to her. Like also like her pictures, like you can tell, like she's dynamic.
Is she one of our feistier?
She's pretty feisty.
Because you seem to tend to like that, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like the girls that either are like headstrong or a little bit feisty or a little bit like know what they're all about, you know?
Yeah. So she definitely knows what she's all about. So Paige, she was born February 2nd, 1960 in Haslett, Michigan to Artis and Carl Ronkowski. And she was one of four daughters. She's the second oldest. She's got her sister Tamara, who's known as Tammy, Cheryl, and Michelle, who often goes by Missy. Now, Carl worked in various law enforcement careers, and Artis worked at GM in Flint, Michigan. And everyone who met Paige was sort of drawn to her. Her mother said, like, when she was little, when she was around four, she had a lisp. And her mom was just, like, really worried that, like, kids would make fun of her for this lisp. But instead, what happened is all these parents were calling her saying like, oh, like my kid is now like mimicking your daughter.
For real?
Yeah.
That's so funny. So were they complaining to her or were they just making her feel better about her daughter's list?
I don't know what the tenor of it was. But yeah, so she just gets all these calls being like, oh, my kid came home.
Copying your kid.
Yeah.
That's really cute.
Yeah. Now, by middle school, Artis and her sisters were living in a different suburb of Lansing, Michigan, called Okemos, in a two-story colonial on a corner lot. And this is really where Paige seemed to flourish. She was known as a tomboy. She was out skateboarding, which if you think of it, it's like relatively early in terms of skateboarding history, right? So she was like an early adopter of the skateboard.
And of girls doing it.
Yeah.
Too, which is really cool.
Yeah, so she was, like, so into it. She even tore a ligament while skateboarding, but that and her cast couldn't stop her from also going swimming, which apparently she also really loved. And her mom remembers picking her up from a swimming pool and having to take her to the doctor's because she'd been swimming with her cast on. So yeah,
Paige. Yeah, that's a kind of a wild feisty thing. Yeah, a wild thing to do.
Yeah. Her mother said Paige was sunshine, and it was true because she was everywhere, kind of enrapturing everyone. Her sister Michelle said she was hysterically funny. She had an incredible sense of humor and was very dramatic. Not life drama. She was involved in drama, theater, singing, music. She was a very talented singer and not a shy person. It's not any wonder then that in high school she was a cheerleader. She was a member of a singing group. She also began to model for local department stores and in bridal shows, even taking part in some dance shows which were sponsored by 17 magazine.
17 magazine. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. I liked that one, but I really liked Sassy. Did you ever read Sassy?
Sassy was so great.
Yeah. It was so great. I wish there was something like that for girls now.
I know. Petition for the return of Sassy. Now, Paige, though, she also had a way of like drawing people into her things, right? Her endeavors, if you will.
Even the lisp.
Well, like, and yeah, and coaxing people into the, like, her projects. Her mom said she became known as the drama queen of the basement because of all the play productions that she would put on in her family's basement. And Paige seemed to love performing so much that her mom said, she would make me hysterical. I always thought she would be an actress. But that's not what Paige wanted. Now, when her sisters graduated, they scattered to different states. Michelle and Cheryl, they went to Atlanta. Tammy went to Chicago. But Paige just wanted to stay close to home in Michigan. In fact, Cheryl said, when she came to visit me, she didn't want to go out to expensive restaurants or the malls. She likes to stay home looking at family pictures. Michelle said she didn't even want to stay long in Atlanta when she did visit. Michelle said, when she came to visit me in Atlanta, she couldn't wait to go home. She was having a good time. She was just very much a homebody.
That's funny. There's these two like very distinct sides to her, like performing and then just wanting to kind of like be at home and be cozy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why everything seemed to come together for her when she met Steve in 1988. Earlier that year, Paige had actually been badly burned in an accident at an outdoor arts festival in downtown Lansing when a propane gas grill exploded and burns had covered a third of her body. So she was still recovering from this very painful and dramatic accident when she met Steven after a Michigan State hockey game. The two of them had ended up at a nearby USA cafe and just clicked when they met each other. Cheryl said by the second date, they were already talking about what they should name their children. Soon, Paige had moved into his ranch home in DeWitt Township, and the two started planning their life together. They became engaged, started working on house projects together. Like, she could just see her whole life unfolding. Steve would work at his job as a resource specialist for the Department of Natural Resources. And Paige, who had just wrapped up her associate's degree in childhood development at Lansing Community College, wanted to go forward with teaching and had enrolled in a program to help children who were deaf. But she also saw herself running her own daycare center from their home. It would be the perfect way to stay home with her own children when they had them. In the meantime, she was working as a substitute teacher at an educational care center in Lansing. Her sister said that Paige's vision for her own life was a little more Little House on the Prairie and less designing women. And honestly, that probably suited Paige just fine. As the only daughter still living in Michigan, Paige and her mom become close. And despite having moved to DeWitt, Paige stopped by her mother's house quite often to help out and to visit. On the morning of May 24th, 1990, Paige drove her little red Toyota to her mother's house and left it there. Paige was driving her mother to the Detroit airport about an hour and a half away, and the two decided to take Artis's larger Cutlass because it would be easier with all the luggage. The two were excited. Artis was on her way to Atlanta to visit her daughters and her grandkids there, and Paige was eager to talk about her wedding with Steve. The two had decided on a November wedding, and they were planning on nailing down a date that weekend. "We had fun. We had a real good time," her mother said of their short trip together. Paige dropped her mom off at the airport sometime between 10:30 a.m. and 11 a.m. From there, her plan was to drive to Canton Township, which was just outside of Detroit, about 20 minutes from the airport. One of Paige's friends lived there and had just had a baby, and Paige was desperate to see them. When she got there, they hung out for a little while, and around 12:30, they decided to go to a park that was between Cherry Hill and Ford Roads in Canton. After spending some time there, they headed back to the friend's house, and Paige left around 2:20 p.m. Now, artists would later say that Paige was not the kind of person to go shopping or take a detour anywhere. She would have left her friend's house and headed straight home. And while that might generally be the case for a homebody like Paige, that's not exactly what she did that day. At around 2:35, she stopped at the Cracker Barrel Party Store, which wasn't far from the park that she had just been at.
Is that like the store inside a Cracker Barrel restaurant?
No, I feel like this is just a party store that has named Cracker Barrel and okay. It's not associated with Cracker Barrel.
I'm like, were there any Cracker Barrels in 1990?
No, so it's like a distinct party store.
That's really funny. So it's just so she stops at the party store.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she stops at the party store, and the manager, Judy, says she very clearly remembered seeing Paige because Paige was buying a 40-ounce bottle of Miller Lite, and she recalled having to card Paige because Paige didn't look old enough to be buying beer. They also had a conversation about Paige's necklace, which was this unusual beaded necklace that Judy admired for a bit before Paige left. And from there, like, things become less defined. Many years later, Livingston Lieutenant Todd Lusaud would describe it as like pieces of a movie film strip, as motorists on I-96 catch mere seconds of a scene as they fly past on the highway. As many as 10 mostly male motorists see Paige that afternoon pulled off the highway somewhere before 3:15 in the afternoon. Each will report something different, and their stories over time will change as memories commonly do, right?
So none of them overlap, aside from her being parked there?
So they are parked there. There's all these drivers going by, and they're kind of like just catching like little bits as they go
by. So they each see a different little scene?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So we know that probably one of the first to really see her is a trucker. He's this man from Windsor, Ontario, and he sees a vehicle pulled over on the side of the road. It's Paige, right? And he sees a tall black man talking to her. He's pretty tall, and his arms are resting on the top of her car roof, and they're having some sort of conversation.
Okay.
Others see her and a man talking outside of her car. Someone else sees her with her hands gesturing in the air, like she's maybe talking with her hands, or maybe she's upset. Others see a man putting his hand on her shoulder. Maybe it's to calm her down. Maybe it's to lead her away. They're all unsure. Some of the reports come in saying that a maroon or red GM or Chrysler minivan is pulled up behind her and that the two are standing between the vehicles. Some report that there may have been another man inside the van.
Huh. So we don't know. She was in the car. She was out of the car. She was next to the car. She was between the vehicles. Was the description of the man the same all the time?
Well, they end up with a variety of different descriptions of the man. About 80% of the people reporting say that the man is black. Most of them report him being tall, somewhere between 5'8 and 6'4.
Okay. That's a very wide range from not tall to very tall.
Very tall. Yeah.
Okay.
But they're all just catching like different glimpses of the scene as they're going past. So it's like trying to piece together their descriptions to come up with like a sequence of events.
Right.
Right.
Huh.
So she's in the car. At some point, she gets out of the car. At some point, she's gesturing with her hands. At some point, maybe he puts his hand on her. And that's where it stops.
Okay.
Because after that, Paige is simply gone.
Huh.
By the time the call comes in about an abandoned vehicle with its lights on the highway, roughly 5 hours has passed.
So nobody else reported that part.
Right. Like, what happens after that point? Like, what's the rest of the movie, right?
But I don't know if I would you?
Well,
you would expect that the person just, like, got out for a moment and was getting back in if you're going by quickly.
Right. Well, so I've been thinking about this. So if I saw people talking on the side of the road, like, have I passed by people on the side of the road talking?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have I passed by vehicles on the side of the road? Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, sometimes, I mean, how many times have you gone by a car that somebody got out to, like, pee on the side of the road?
Uh-huh.
So you don't want to just barge over and be like, hey, is everything all right? When and then to have some man pop out of the bushes peeing.
Right. Yeah.
So,
I mean, even on this road that kind of leads in the direction of my house. Like, there's been plenty of times I've seen vehicles kind of left on the side of the road. And, like, I've seen them, like, over the course of several days. And, like, the most I think is, like, huh, the car's still there.
Right. So I don't know. Like, is it weird not to report this? Probably not.
Yeah. So I don't think that's... It's only after...
The man who reported it is just because he saw it twice. Mm-hmm. Probably didn't think anything of it the first time.
Yeah.
Huh.
I think also because its headlights are on.
Yeah.
It's a little more unusual. Like, why is its headlights on?
Yeah.
But when he passes by earlier, he doesn't really think about it, right?
Right.
Now, again, this to the police, when they show up, reads as an abandoned vehicle. So it is not processed as a crime scene. There's no photos taken of the car or its surroundings before it's towed, because this is just an abandoned vehicle. Inside, they do note that Paige's purse is on the seat. It does have her ID. It does have money inside. There's also a mostly empty beer.
So she was drinking her beer?
Yep.
Okay.
And also, Paige's shoes are on the floor.
Like the ones she was wearing that day?
Yes.
So she's out shoeless.
Correct.
That's weird.
Well, this does seem at first odd, right?
Okay.
Like, why are her shoes in the car? And, like, they do end up taking photos later. They're in the driver's side. And it's something that people go back to even now.
Like, right. Like, why wouldn't they
not have her shoes on? Right.
And why wouldn't they take it as not an abandoned vehicle when they see the shoes?
Right. Now, Paige... Though, to be clear, her family says she did often take her shoes off in the car. So it was typical for her to be driving without her shoes on. Like, that was normal.
Is that legal?
Yeah.
To drive barefoot?
Is there a law somewhere?
I don't know. I feel like growing up in Canada, I had a teacher who liked to drive barefoot, but he said it was illegal.
Oh, is this? Huh.
But I don't know. I mean, is it illegal everywhere, just in Canada? Or was he just saying that because he didn't want other people doing it too? Like,
well, so I did learn in the course of my journeys that
it is illegal. We have someone fact checking it right now. So it is legal in the US, but not recommended.
Okay. I did learn in my investigations that women tend to take their shoes off more often when driving, which makes sense because our shoes tend to be...
It's probably honestly safer to drive barefoot than in heels.
Yes.
Because it could get, like, snagged on your carpet or something.
It's true.
Okay, so we just have the check on Canada, too, and it is legal. So I don't know why that teacher said that to us, but apparently you can even drive your motorcycle barefoot if you want.
Apparently. But I also learned that the other thing that you should be aware of when you are driving barefoot, if you are choosing to drive barefoot, is, like, also you have to worry about, like, your shoes shifting underneath your, like, brake or gas pedal. So, like...
Right. It's like having a rolling bottle or something else that you're not supposed to have down there.
Yeah.
So you should probably not leave your shoes at your feet when you take them off. You should probably take them off and put them over somewhere else.
Yeah. Anyway.
For anyone listening, do the safe thing if you are a barefoot driver.
We'll be back in a moment. Now, Paige was a barefoot driver.
Okay.
Okay. So this part is not unusual for her. The part that is unusual is that she must have had them off when she was seen outside of her vehicle talking to the man. So that meant she would have stepped out and was standing on the gravel, on the shoulder. Like, that seems
unusual. I don't know. Some people can walk on gravel. Can you? Barefoot? I can't. I'm such a baby.
I'm a delicate creature. No.
You can't either.
No. Now, so for now.
Okay.
This is just an abandoned car situation to the sheriff. Mm-hmm. So they call Artis's house again. They leave that message on her answering machine. Artis, though, she's away in Atlanta, so she's not going to be there to get that message.
So how long is she gone for? Because that's the same day she left.
Yeah.
She might not see that message for a week.
Right. But back in DeWitt, though, someone was aware that Paige wasn't where she needed to be, and that's her fiancé, Steven.
Okay.
They were set to meet up that evening for his softball game, and Steven's immediately concerned when Paige doesn't arrive. So one of the things that Paige is known for is being where she says she's going to be.
Okay.
So perhaps thinking she could be at her mother's or something's wrong, he drives to Oakmoss, but Paige isn't there. He is so concerned that he literally breaks into Artis's home. Like, this man is not chill about this situation.
I mean, that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes we've had like the opposite.
Where you're like hesitant.
They're like, oh, it's fine. She'll turn up.
Right. No, he is not that. So inside is the answering machine and it's flashing. So pressing play, he hears a message from Livingston County Sheriff's reporting that Artis's car was found on the side of the road. So Stephen knows that something terrible must be happening. He calls Artis in Atlanta and asks where Paige was. Artis would later say, the minute her boyfriend called me at 9 p.m. at night and she was to be home at 3 p.m., it was like I was hit in the stomach. Paige wasn't one to be late for anything. I just knew something was very, very wrong. And when they called me about midnight and said they found the car, I was numb, absolutely numb. So Stephen, learning that Artis doesn't know where she is either, that she should have been back home, he drives to the town, Howell, and he reports her missing. And by midnight that night, everyone knew what they were dealing with, a missing persons case.
Just to loop back for a minute, do we know what time everyone was passing her on the road?
Yes. So they saw her before 3:15 p.m.
They saw her before 3:15. Okay. Very early in the day.
Yep. And then the motorist calls about seeing the car at 7:58. Stevens calling Artis at 9 p.m. So
things are actually moving along quickly.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is unusual.
It is.
And everyone takes it seriously as soon as they're like, no.
Which is also unusual.
Mm-hmm. Now, this car, though, it had been previously treated like an abandoned vehicle. Now it becomes a possible crime scene. The location on the side of the road where it was found is treated as the same, although critical information is in danger of being lost, even as the sheriffs are descending on both, right? Because time is passing.
But also, did they contaminate the car at all?
It's possible, yeah.
Okay.
Now, the car does undergo processing. Though they won't say it publicly for many years, they do obtain palm prints from the trunk and about 20 fingerprints from inside the vehicle. They aren't a clear match to anyone who would have left prints there. They're also not a clear match to anyone in the databases that are available to them. And the car itself is clean. There's no blood or DNA evidence inside that would point to anyone. And it's also in good mechanical condition, meaning it's fully functioning and running. This will become one of the sticking points in one of the theories about Paige's disappearance. Because one of the biggest questions in her case will always be, why did Paige pull over that day? What brought her to the side of the road? Was she experiencing car issues? Did she stop to help someone? Was she forced or coerced off the road? Now, everyone in Paige's life is adamant that she would not have stopped on the highway even to render aid to someone. And I mean, everyone says this. After hearing about how witnesses saw her outside the car, her mother said, she's a helpful person, but she would never have stopped for a stranger for any reason. This is unbelievable. This new information does not make sense. What prompted her to stop and to get out? And Steve, he said she wasn't the type who would have stopped on the side of the road either. And he said, not unless it was somebody she knew. She's smarter than that. Even her mom's neighbor, Linda, whose kids Paige had babysat, said, Paige was a sweetheart who lectured my kids about not getting in cars with strangers. She was like my kid, their sister. With Paige's regular behavior in mind, looking at what happened that day between about 2:35-ish and 3:15 becomes a Herculean task for the investigators. The fact that the inspection of the car yielded no mechanical issues ruled out the possibility that something was wrong with the vehicle itself, and she pulled over, leading her to what we will call an opportunistic abduction. And most reports said there was no physical damage to the car. It's only recently that investigators have started to say that there was actually a small amount of front end damage, but nothing glaring. That has led some to wonder if Paige was purposefully bumped, or I guess more specifically in this case, brake checked, leading her to pull over. They've also wondered if it's possible if Paige could have been badged, meaning that someone pulled up near her, flashed a badge at her to get her to pull over.
That's terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Now, if Paige had just left the party store with a 40-ounce Miller Lite and the bottle was mostly empty when investigators found the car, it means it's possible that she was drinking on her drive. Now, could Paige, who sounds like a rule follower, have gotten nervous or panicked if someone flashed a badge at her and pulled over? Like, even if they were in an unmarked vehicle? These are really our questions we don't have answers to. All we know is that Paige's vehicle was functioning. There was also no skin marks in the area where her car was found, no signs of a struggle in the gravel shoulder. Paige Rinkowski was simply gone.
So it is really weird. I was going to ask about that. Like, what would make her pull over? And and all of these things sound plausible, but are there any other theories?
Yeah. So circulating at the time are some other kind of rumors and theories. One is that she had had some disagreements with her fiance.
Steve.
Yes. Could that have been anything? But on the other hand, you know, she was in the car with her mom talking about her wedding and planning her wedding. So that doesn't seem likely. Her mother would also later say that other people had theorized that she had, like, run away. But why would she have driven her mom to an airport where she could have left for anywhere in the country, gone to go see a friend, and then randomly stopped on the side of the road as part of disappearing herself, right?
Right. Like, curiosity, I guess. I don't know if we covered it. Mm-hmm. Was she heading towards home?
Yes.
Oh, so then, again, that's not running away.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. So she's about, okay, where she is about like a 30-ish minute drive from home. So she's most of the way there.
Okay. Huh.
Now, the search for Paige is immediate. Investigators search large swaths of land where her car was found, and the local news picks up her story. This is how investigators are able to get those eyewitness accounts of Paige on the side of the road, but each described what they saw differently, as we know. And ultimately, at least 6 composite sketches would be created in her case, and each would show a different man or men who looked very different from one another.
Again, it's so hard to, like, I don't think I could piece together someone's description driving by on a road, like, going that quickly.
Yeah, absolutely not. So to me, it doesn't...
And it never makes sense, the height thing. I cannot look at a person and be like, yeah, that person is approximately 5'8". Mm-hmm. I would never try to guess that even.
Yeah.
Be like, tallish, thinnish, heavyish. Like, I can't tell.
Mm-hmm. Like, I only have, you know, I was thinking about this as well. Like, when I've driven past people, like, what would I be able to describe of anyone I've ever passed by? Like,
maybe the color of their coat.
Yeah.
Or the color of their hair. Like, there's really not much I would actually see and retain.
Right.
Especially if it didn't look unusual.
Exactly. So there's a bunch of sketches that result from
it. Makes sense, though, to me.
Her friends and family, they really hit the ground running, like, trying to find her. Like, basically, Artis and her daughters, like, are able to get back home pretty quickly. They gather around Artis's kitchen table. They're assembling packets of, like, missing persons flyers. So many that soon Paige's face is actually showing up in locations across the United States. A local billboard company donated space on 20 billboards, and over 100 movie theaters started showing her missing person information before the start of movies. Steve himself, he runs himself ragged trying to find her. He said, I just can't stop until there's absolutely nothing left to do. As long as there's any possibility at all that she might be found alive, you can't. He and his friends actually sit alongside I-96 and watch for passing vans and are writing down license plates numbers to turn into the sheriff's office. They're holding out hope that whoever took Paige will just pass by and that would just be a regular route that they were taking. The search really weighs heavily on everyone who loved Paige. Steve says that he's been sleeping on the living room floor. He's too devastated to sleep in their bedroom where a wedding planning book is still waiting beside Paige's side of the bed. He really did hold out hope that she would come back to him, but even so, he would catch himself in interviews referring to Paige in the past tense. Carl, her father, has a seizure just days after and is hospitalized. And though I think she kept this truth for herself for a long time, Artis would later say, after the second day, I knew she was no longer alive. In my heart, I knew. When I told people that, they'd ask, don't you have any hope for her? Of course I have hope. But the reality, and I'm a realist.
Yeah, it's got to be incredibly stressful, especially when it's so random. Did her father have the seizure because of the stress?
I think so, yeah. He ends up passing away 4 years after Paige's disappearance, pretty young. And the family will say, like, he did have health issues, but they think that her disappearance just weighed so much on him. 1 year, though, into Paige being missing, two of her sisters and their father gave a press conference hoping to call attention to her case. Cheryl said, we have to get on with our lives. I can't handle all the stress. We've realized that everyone in the family has to deal with it separately. We try to make it as normal as possible. And Cheryl, at least, trusted the work the investigators were doing. She said that the family has to let the police do their job and not to spend every day thinking about it constantly. And then she said, I don't think anyone can. If you do, you're either a saint or one crazy person.
Well, and each member of that family is going to have to deal with it in their own way.
Exactly.
For some people, it's going to be searching constantly. And for some, it's going to be letting the police do their job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some people, it's going to be distraction. And some people are going to develop different theories and thoughts about what happened to her. Right.
Yeah.
Because there's just so many unknowns in Paige's case.
And just so many, like, different coping ways.
Yeah. Now, despite what is actually a pretty robust news coverage, and despite the efforts from everyone who loves her, despite the efforts from investigators, Paige's case grows cold. In the first year, investigators had fielded 700 tips, but soon that dwindled to a trickle. 4 years in, one of the investigators, Ivan Deering, said, "We're no closer to finding her today than we were the day she disappeared. There's been a whole lot of work done. Every possible angle, I think, we've covered." The years passed, and over, Paige's case was looked at again and again. Various suspects have been investigated, including two men, one of whom was known for badging, like flashing a badge at someone to get them to pull over. Other suspects have been in prison for crimes. Several serial killers were looked into. At one point, investigators said that they felt they had six solid suspects to look at. But despite what seemed like promising leads, none felt solid enough to move forward with. By 2011, Paige's case was turned over to three retired detectives who spent their time working cold cases like Paige's. They scanned over everything, kind of revisiting leads as though they were new. That's how they came across a hand-drawn map and a two-page handwritten letter that was in her case file.
Where did those come from?
So over the years, right, her file's getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
People are putting stuff in. And then they hand this file over to these, like, three cold case retired guys who just are going over everything with, like, fresh eyes. So they discover this map, this handwritten letter that's been in her file for a while. They learn it had been delivered to the Livingston County Sheriff's Department 6 months after Paige disappeared, and no one at the time knew who sent it.
That's so weird.
Now, the writer of this letter says that they had heard about where Paige might be buried and that the map they drew led to that location. The writer says that this might be a red herring. They weren't sure, meaning they weren't sure that this was a real story that they were told. So the letter becomes known as the red herring letter. The team of retired investigators got to work on this. They were equipped this time with ground penetrating radar, and they searched the area on the map. They brought out cadaver dogs, but to no avail. Paige wasn't found there. The retired investigators later learned that the original team had also searched this area for Paige as well, back in 1990, 1991, also obviously without success. Now, one thing that is unusual in what the retired detectives are doing is that in their quest to find Paige, they revealed a lot of information to the press. Mm-hmm. And this is actually the first time that Paige's mother had learned about the map and the letter. She said, "I don't understand. Was it a hoax? I don't really think it was, but what if it was? It's a cruel hoax." Despite the efforts by the cold case team and investigators since, Paige has remained missing.
It's one of those things with the letter. It's probably something that somebody overheard and then kind of wanted to, just in case there was some truth to it.
Mm-hmm. So as I spent time with Paige's story, what immediately becomes clear to me is the vast number of crimes against women, particularly murders and missing persons cases that happened in this part of Michigan around the same time. There were so many that had similar features to Paige, who was blonde, blue-eyed, she was very distinct, right? Or there were disappearances like that mirrored her in some way. So they had some details that seemed very similar. With each case, Paige's name would be invoked in newspaper articles as even reporters began to ponder whether or not there were connections. It even led Robert Ressler, who is an author on FBI profiles and serial killers, to proclaim in 1992, "It sounds like we've got a Bundy on the loose." But over the years, many of those cases closed, each with different perpetrators, which to me is actually more frightening than a serial killer, like that the real answer to this is that there was just widespread violence against women.
It's much more frightening. Mm-hmm. That there's many people capable instead of just piling all on one person.
Exactly. Early in Paige's disappearance, though, one woman is mentioned. Her name is Beverly Wivel. Beverly Wivel was a 30-year-old woman, and in late September 1989, so months before Paige went missing, because Paige is May 1990, she brought her son to school. And later that morning, Beverly was found in the road on Gottfredson Road in Canton Township. She'd been shot in the side and her legs had been run over by at least one vehicle. Although that part could have been accidental due to there was a heavy fog cover that day. That evening, her car was found in a Canton park, its headlights still on and its engine running.
Wait, I remember Canton Park from earlier in the story.
Yes. So this is the same park that Paige had gone to the day she went missing.
Okay.
So Paige visited there. She also went and got a beer at a store close to the park on the day she went missing. And Beverly, her car was found there.
Okay.
On the day she was murdered.
And Beverly's the same age.
Yes.
Are there any other similarities?
So it doesn't just stop at the age or how their vehicles were found. Both women are blonde and blue-eyed. Both women's belongings were in their vehicles. Both of their shoes were in their cars.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So when I first read these articles in 1989 and 1990, right, I was like, oh, well, this must be it, right? These women have to be connected. There's too many similarities.
They're but really similar.
I did learn that Beverly was actually between housing. And so she often slept in her car, which makes her shoes or her belongings being found in her car less of a big deal. Of course, her stuff was in her car because she slept there.
Okay.
But other than that, I'm not even someone who likes to speculate, and I speculated on this, right? Because there's just too much going on.
Right.
But law enforcement at the time, they end up saying they can't find anything definitive to link the two. But yes, there's a lot of similarities, but nothing is directly connected here. Just this year, though, so 2025, a man was arrested and charged in Beverly's murder. Beverly was believed to have been sexually assaulted during the attack, and this man's DNA was found inside her. Now, this case against him for Beverly has a long way to go. The arrest is pretty recent, and his lawyers argue that the presence of his DNA just means that they had intercourse, not that he's responsible for her murder. But it has caused a resurgence of interest in Paige's case.
So I know how you operate a lot of the time. So did you go down the Beverly rabbit hole?
I do. Yeah. So Beverly, I think what is actually sad to me about the recent developments in Beverly's case is that I do think it's great that Paige's name is being brought up.
Right.
On the other hand, I've read whole articles that are not about Beverly herself or her case, but are about here's all the details about Paige's disappearance.
So there's nothing really just about Beverly without Paige?
Yeah, so it's hard to find a lot of Beverly without
Paige. Might be a good topic for...
Yeah, so I think I'm going to write...
Are you
going
to do something?
...about Beverly for my Girl Hunt newsletter.
Okay.
So, because I think I just want also to honor her story...
Separate. ...from Paige's.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the future we look for that on Girl Hunt?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm glad that... It has caused more interest in Paige's case.
Yeah, but...
On the other hand, I also want there to be interest in Beverly's story as well. Now, Paige's family is definitely aware of these developments in the case, that this man has been arrested for Beverly's murder. And they say whatever is happening is only in its early stages, right? But I hope this means that, however it turns out, that Paige's story is being shared once again. So, here we are telling Paige's story. But I want to bring it back to Paige and the work her family has done, not just for Paige, but in creating a legacy of advocacy around her disappearance. At one point, artist Paige's mom said during an interview, "I couldn't cry for quite a while. And once I started, I couldn't stop for months. That's how, right now, my heart is pounding. You can't survive by living at that level of emotion. You learn that quickly. I was determined I was going to make it, and I have." And to Artis, who is an absolute force, making it actually meant helping other families experiencing what she had. She'd always lended her support, but by the mid-aughts, that meant advocating for the National Missing and Unidentified Persons Database, or NAMIS, just been instrumental in solving cases. She was one of the first parents of a missing child to contribute her DNA to the database. She worried about the possibility that Paige had already been found somewhere and was just somewhere unidentified. At the time, Artis said, "It's like an incision that has healed, but every now and then some stitches break open and I begin to bleed all over again." Artis was also instrumental in the creation of Missing in Michigan, which is an advocacy group that hosts yearly conferences to bring together families, law enforcement, the media, and other groups to increase awareness and advocacy for the missing. In 2015, she was given the Michigan State Police Missing in Michigan Advocate of the Year Award for her work, and it's now been renamed the Artis Runkowski Advocate of the Year Award. Artis passed away in 2017 at the age of 84. Those who knew her were heartbroken that she passed away before knowing what happened to Paige. On February 2nd, 2018, a double memorial was held for Artis and Paige. It would have been Paige's 58th birthday. Of her passing, Michelle said, "I think she knows everything now. That's my feeling. My mom knows everything that's possible to know about Paige and what happened. We're hoping she'll send us a sign." This May, Paige has been missing for 35 years.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, All American Dream, read by Belle Adams. Belle is best known for her roles in Sex Lives of College Girls, Bless This Mess, and HBO's New Perry Mason. Belle has also worked in Crohn's, the CBS show SWAT, Speechless, Bizardvark, Grownish, and Solve. Adept with both comedy and drama, Belle made a splash in the critically acclaimed instant cult classic horror film, Two Witches, and was awarded Best Actress for her work as the lead in indie feature film, This World Alone. Belle has also appeared in shows on MTV and Lifetime, along with international and national commercials for products like California Lottery, LG, Condé Nast, and more. An Atlanta-area, Georgia-grown gal, Belle had plenty of experience acting in her childhood and teens and has expanded her pursuits into directing, filmmaking, and producing. She's an active singer-songwriter and has written and directed her own series, short films, and music videos, and continues to write and develop original content and visual art. She believes in the power of giving and looks forward to any opportunity to connect and work alongside open and committed artists.
All American Dream. Paige Runkowski, 30, missing since May 24, 1990, from Fowlerville, Michigan. The headlights are on, but nobody's home. Another empty night with a woman gone. There's not enough to say about what's left behind. The road stretches out like any other night on an endless route that no headlights light. They tow it out of frame, edges blur and fade. Purse and shoes on the driver's side. Every clue has so much to hide. The cops drift away as the camera lens strays. And the earth keeps turning. The nights keep fading. Every tidewater keeps on rising. And we won't stop thinking. There's not enough to say about what's left behind.
For more information about our show, please visit shegoesbyjanepodcast.com.
Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.